I'm Jack Stein, sitting in for Dory Monson this afternoon. Welcome to the 2 o'clock hour. Let's get right into the big lead.
The big lead, top national.
You know, if you had asked me 5 or 6 years ago what I wanted to do with my life, I would have told you that I wanted to edit footage and be on the radio. That was kind of my two goals in life. And if you had told me that at some point in time I would be editing footage or looking at footage of a 13-year-old boy who had been shot by the police, I would have said, you're crazy. You are absolutely insane. There is no way that I would ever do that. And lo and behold, this weekend, I pulled the footage of the shooting of Adam Toledo, 13-year-old boy in a little village in Chicago, and I went through it frame by frame because there is a tremendous amount of misinformation out there and there's a tremendous amount of disinformation out there about the shooting of Adam Toledo, and it's really quite sad because I can tell you after studying the film and going through it beat by beat that there is no possible way that the officer could have known that Adam Toledo did not have a gun in his hands. So before I go through the footage, let me just explain to you what we're going to listen to. You're going to hear the officer chasing Adam Toledo down an alleyway. Adam Toledo has a firearm in his right hand. He stops at a certain point in time, and he is trying to conceal it from the officer with the right side of his body. He has turned away from the officer. There is a little bit of a hole in the fence. It's kind of an incomplete fence. And then Adam Toledo goes to throw the gun behind the fence so that the officer won't see it, and then turn around and put his hands up. So in that single motion where he throws the gun and then turns around, it's about 8/10 of a second or 9/10 of a second. According to my calculations, just going through it frame by frame, it's about 8/10 of a second. There is no possible way that any living, breathing human being could have known. It's 2:30 in the morning. It's dark. How could anybody possibly see that his hands were empty, particularly when he had the firearm before? So when we think about what happened to this police officer, we have to take it from his perspective. How could he possibly know that Adam Toledo had thrown the gun behind the fence? It's really frustrating, especially when I see the coverage from other media outlets. I won't necessarily name them here, but let's just say one of the many three-letter media companies decided to crop out the image so that you cannot see the firearm when Adam Toledo throws it. But thankfully, I was able to pull it from the BBC, and they have the unedited version of the shooting. And you can clearly see Adam Toledo has a firearm, and the slide is back, meaning the gun is empty. But again, at 2:30 in the morning, how could the officer possibly know? It wouldn't matter if he was RoboCop. It would not matter if he was Iron Man. There is no possible way that he could have known. So I'm hearing all of this kind of talk about racism in the United States, and I'm hearing all of this kind of talk about what it means to be a black or a brown person in the United States. And I'm thinking that we are missing the point, particularly when we're talking about the tragic death of a 13-year-old boy. So here is what it sounds like to you, and I'll just kind of narrate over the top of it so that you can understand what this exactly is. Here's Adam Toledo running down the alleyway. And the officer tells him to stop. Right there, he throws the gun and he gets shot. That is how fast it happens.
Shots fired. Get an ambulance up here now.
So he simultaneously stops, throws the gun, turns around. How could the officer possibly know? And anybody out there who tries to tell me, anybody who tries to say, oh, you know, Jack, officers should be trained better. I don't know of a human being who could have reacted in 8/10 of a second. Again, we could go back, you know, I could go back in the keyboard, forward on the keyboard. It's a single frame between throwing, turning, and firing. So it's just a tragedy. And rather than talk about it in that way, rather than talk about it in the way that we might really talk about something that's really difficult. Why was a 13-year-old boy out at 2:30 in the morning? Why had his mom reported him missing something like 4 days earlier, and then he comes back home, she doesn't call the police to say that he's back, and then he leaves again? What is he doing with a 21-year-old man? Rather than talk about that, everything that I'm seeing now is talking about racism. Racism's a really easy out when it comes to this kind of thing. Racism's a really easy way to say, well, it's obviously just a racist cop. It's really hard to say something like, well, where's mom? Where's dad? Why is Adam Toledo out with a 21-year-old man? Why is he allegedly being called Baby Diablo or Little Homicide, according to Andy Ngo? Why is this all going on? See, that would actually take time and thought and effort. And unfortunately, there are members of the media out there who don't want to talk about what it means for a little boy to grow up without a dad around or without a mom around. You know, I was really disappointed in Sean Hannity, actually, because he came out on his radio show and he said something that was just absolutely disgusting. Said he was a young 13-year-old man, according to Hannity. He was an armed teen known in gang circles as Little Homicide and Baby Diablo. That's according to right-wing journalist Andy Ngo, who I have a lot of appreciation for and a lot of respect for. But we can't obfuscate this and we can't kind of cloud this and say, oh, well, he was a young 13-year-old man. That's a little boy. You know, so I'm really disappointed with some of my contemporaries on the right who are trying to make this out to be something that it's not. This is a little boy who got caught up in gang activity. You know, if you do any research on this, what you'll see is with young men and women, but young men in particular, is that when they don't integrate vertically to their parents, meaning socially, when they don't integrate upwards to coaches or teachers, when they don't have somebody to look up to, they will integrate horizontally. In age, meaning people in their own peer groups, in their own peer circles. This has been well established for decades at this point in time. This is how people get associated with gangs because there is no mom and there is no dad. There's nobody there to set a good example. There's nobody there to say, hey, it's 10:30. It's time to go to bed. No, you're not going to go out with this random loser at 2:30 in the morning. So Adam Toledo had integrated or was in the process of integrating socially horizontally, right? He hasn't attached to anybody, and so he's attaching to this random 21-year-old guy. And if I had to say this, if you want to pin the murder of Adam Toledo on anybody, it would either be mom, dad, or this loser that he was hanging out with. Because I ask you again, where was mom? Where was dad? Lori Lightfoot would like you to think that this has something to do with racism. Lori Lightfoot would like you to think that this has something to do with some kind of systemic policing issue, anything but the real issue. Isn't it so funny that so many Democrats out there, and I really wish I could reach people with a D over their name, this shooting, this killing, has nothing to do with racism. You could run around all you want and you can say that, but that's not going to fix bad mom, bad dad. That's not going to fix the problem in your community. So before we get off on that tangent, here is Mayor Lori Lightfoot saying, well, there are two factors that come into this case. Here's Lori Lightfoot last week.
The facts about this tragedy remain clear. First, in the middle of the night, this child was in contact with an adult who had a gun and then ended up being shot and killed by a police officer. And second, there are too many young people in our city, boys and girls alike, who have been left vulnerable by systemic failures that we simply must fix.
Okay. All right.
These two realities urge us to reckon with and address the relationship between the police, our communities, and especially our young people.
Oh, that's what it is.
In turn, we must deal with the cancerous role of illegal firearms that plague every Chicago community.
Anything but mom and dad. Anything but mom and dad. She goes on for 15 minutes, and I got to tell you, when I saw this on Wednesday, it made my blood absolutely boil. She goes on for 15 minutes. Well, it's got to be the police. Well, it's got to be systemic racism. Well, it's got to be gun control. Anything but saying, what does it mean to have a mom and what does it mean to have a dad? And there are so many people out there that I'm sure are upset about this. And they say, well, Jack, it obviously has to be racism because the officer had this kind of record or that kind of record. Again, I encourage you to watch the footage and you tell me that you would have made a better decision at 2:30 in the morning with 0.8 seconds to make a decision. So we can do this song and dance all day long. You want to talk about, oh, the systemic relationship between this community and the police or that community and the police. You want to talk about systemic racism. You want to talk about gun control. It's not going to fix anything. And what's even more challenging about the whole issue is if you were to ask me, well, Jack, why did Adam Toledo run? Because he was clearly afraid of the police. Why did he run? Well, I would say to you that there is a narrative out there that mainstream media loves to propagate, which is that young black and brown men are being gunned down in the street willy-nilly. There is a narrative out there that suggests that if you are stopped by the police, that you are going to be killed. We saw this with Dante Wright. I'm sure that contributed to his reasoning for wanting to run from the police. Dante Wright, 20 years old, gets pulled over by the police. They're about to arrest him. He decides that he wants to pull away, get back in his car. He gets shot. He then drives away and runs into another car. So there is something going on with the young boys in this country who are minority boys, where they are being told that the police, you have to fear the police at all costs. Not only do you have to fear the police, but you have to run from the police. So you can talk about all this stuff all you want, but it doesn't make any difference to me because we're not even speaking the same language at this point in time. You can talk about systemic racism. You can talk about all that other kind of garbage. It's still not going to fix the problem. You can talk about defunding the police. Fine, it's not going to fix the problem. Again, when young boys, when they don't have a dad or a coach or anybody else to look up to, a teacher, when they don't have anybody else to look up to, they will find someone to look up to. They will find something to do. And in Adam Toledo's case, it was being up at 2:30 in the morning, firing off a 9mm. And if you say, well, Jack, that's just speculation, that's just a rumor. Well, according to the crime report, he's got gun residue on the side of his hand. And from what I saw in the footage that I went through beat by beat, frame by frame, he's got an empty gun in his hands. You know, it's weird. We all kind of turn into junior experts when this kind of thing comes up. We all kind of turn into junior detectives. And I can tell you that I went into this not knowing what actually happened. And it wasn't until I saw that single frame where he's got the gun in his hand that I say, oh, no. Now I know exactly what happened. So on MSNBC, on Andrea Mitchell Reports, they had a Princeton professor. His name is Eddie Gall Jr. And again, instead of talking about mom and dad, instead of talking about what it means to be part of a community, what it means to be part of a church organization, instead of talking about that, what does he talk about? Ronald Reagan. Ah, yes, good old Gipper. We got to go back to 1988, and that's where we're going to find the root cause of Adam Toledo's death. We have to go all the way back to Ronnie to figure out what happened to Adam Toledo. Here's what that sounded like last week.
We figure out how to move forward and have the next iteration of this conversation. What do we need to be focused on right now?
Well, let me just say, Casey, you're absolutely right. Not only are families grieving, but you can imagine as these images are on loop and they're kind of layered on top of each other, you have to imagine communities, black folk around the country, terrorized in interesting sorts of ways, in problematic ways, by having to see these images over and over again. Not only because they're horrific, but because they generate an occasion for us to worry about our own family members, about our own lives, about our children, our husbands, our wives, our aunts, our mothers, our fathers, that sort of thing. So that's the first thing. The second thing is that we have to understand that for a generation, that the age of Reagan was defined by a form of policing black and brown communities that had violence at its core. We thought of these folks as super predators. We thought of tough on crime as the way in which we modeled it. Remember the black box in Chicago emerges out of this framework. You think about ramparts in Los Angeles. You think about the very ways in which our communities have been perceived to justify this form of policing.
So this is all just nonsense, right? I mean, he's just talking and he's not saying anything. And you want to know why nothing gets done about this kind of stuff? You want to know why there's like 15, 16 shootings a weekend in Chicago? Do you want to know why there's a gang activity like how we saw 2 weeks ago in Seattle where a 2-year-old little girl got shot? You want to know why all this happens? Because nobody wants to talk about the most difficult aspect of all of this, which is what does it mean to raise children without a father around? What does it mean to have a culture which promotes promiscuity? What does it mean to have children effectively raised by the television where they're seeing this kind of hyper-masculine representation of what it means to be an adult? It's all really difficult. And I'll tell you what happens when people do try to talk about it. They say, well, you're a racist. You want to talk about the black community? You want to talk about the brown community? Well, you're a racist. You know, I'll tell you, when I lived in California, one of the things that I noticed is that, especially when I was in community college, one of the things I noticed is that there was a tremendous amount of Hispanic people who were in my classes, and they would always say the same thing. They would always say, you do those like icebreakers at the beginning of class. And they would say, I'm a first generation college student, and I'm here because of my mom and my dad. And they would get all emotional, and they would say, my mom and dad worked so hard to get me to this position where I could go to community college or I could go to a university. And so you ask yourself, how is it that that community in California does so well and sends so many young men and women off to community college or college who go on to do great things with their lives? And why is it that another community still kind of likes to hover around in this idea of, well, the police are systemically racist. It's the system that is against us. I'll tell you how you end up with an Adam Toledo is when you tell young boys or young people in general that the police are out to get them, that the system is flawed and will never work for them, that they have no future because the white man is always trying to keep them down, that they live in a racist country with no future, and that there's always going to be somebody out there, whether it's a judge or a police officer or a teacher or a coach, who doesn't actually care about them. This is how you end up with an Adam Toledo. Because if you go around with this myth, or you walk around with this idea that your life is meaningless and that you are meaningless, you will end up out at 2:30 in the morning with some loser. And it's so difficult to talk about, and it is so weighty to talk about, that I think that likely what will happen is we will continue to go down this road of talking about racism and talking about how people are being oppressed, and we will completely miss the real core of this, which is, what does it mean to belong to a community? And what does it mean to have value inside of a community? What does it mean to have a mom and a dad who say, hey, you got to be in bed by 10:30 because you got to go to school the next day? What does it mean for children to have that? Because I can tell you that the future of how you want to fix everything that's wrong with the United States, it's not talking about Reagan. It's not saying, oh, well, this is with a 13-year-old boy, as Sean, or a 13-year-old man, as Sean Hannity said. The way that you fix the future is you raise children in a loving and in a peaceful environment. This is how you avoid things like a Dante Wright or an Adam Toledo. Or what we could do is we could keep talking about racism, and we could keep talking about oppression in the United States. We could keep doing that, and we can end up with a dozen more Adam Toledos and a dozen more Dante Wrights. I personally would rather talk about the difficult part of this. Or we could talk about the easy part of it. Either way, it's your choice. We have to take a really quick break here on the Dory Monson Show. I'm Jack Stein, filling in for Mr. Dory Monson. We'll be right back after this. All right, welcome back to the Dory Monson Show. On the line right now is National Treasure Hannah Scott, who wants to fill us in on what's going on with the Compassion Seattle. What do you want to call it, Hannah Scott? What's the actual name to kind of fill it out for people? What's it actually called?
It's called it's a proposed ballot initiative that would change the charter for the city of Seattle, and it is from the group Compassion Seattle.
Right.
So it's a big change if it passes.
Okay, well, let's hit your feature, and then we'll discuss afterwards. Here's what that sounds like.
The proposed ballot initiative would tweak the city charter in order to require certain actions by the city to actually make a visible difference on homelessness and get people housed. When it was announced on the first of this month, the idea was...
For too long, our city has allowed this problem to continue to get worse and worse and worse. And people in Seattle want a compassionate response, and they want something done.
That's Aaron Goodman with Soto Business Improvement District, who's part of Compassion Seattle, the group of unlikely allies made up of neighborhood activists and homeless advocates. And while the group's goal has not changed, the language in their ballot initiative has.
So these changes really follows some discussions with various area organizations that are committed to resolving Seattle's homelessness crisis. So we've updated the language, provided a little bit more clarification, specifically around what this amendment means for the city of Seattle.
Mike Stewart is executive director of the Ballard Alliance and part of the Compassion Seattle group, and says there are really three key changes.
So the updated charter amendment, it includes new languages that ensures that the city would really take a person-centered approach to fixing the crisis, noting that, you know, any work relocating people to housing should avoid any possible harm to individuals caused by closing encampments. It's kind of a first important point.
So a bit of a softer touch than the original language when it comes to keeping the parks and sidewalks clear. But the second change
also reaffirms that the city would have the ability to close encampments that create problems related to public safety or public health, or interfere with the use of public spaces by others.
And the third change
is that a sunset provision was put in place. So meaning that, assuming this was passed by voters at the end of this year, 6 years later in the end of 2027, the charter amendment would then sunset at that point in time.
Why the sunset clause, ending the mandate after just 6 years?
Well, the hope would be that after 6 years' time of really taking a new fundamental approach with a significant amount of accountability built into it, that we will have, as a community, really gotten a good handle on this issue, this important issue, and then meaning a charter level mandate would not be required at that point. That's certainly the hope.
Stewart says the changes were made based on various feedback they got following the initial release, and that the bottom line is this gives the charter amendment the best chance of actually passing to get something done.
I think there's a tremendous amount of support and it's growing. And I think Seattleites are absolutely compassionate. 100%. And I think we've all just been looking for what is the right solution. And I think sometimes people perhaps appear less compassionate, but perhaps only because we feel like the programs that we have in place right now just aren't working and aren't doing the job.
The one change not made, anything to address concerns about this being an unfunded mandate on the city. But Compassion Seattle remains committed to its position that the city of Seattle has the money to cover the investments in shelter and other things required in this amendment to pull from other areas. It just doesn't say which areas those should be.
So, Hannah Scott, when I was homeless, one of the biggest issues that I had was that it was almost as if all services were intentionally spread out to make the entire system incredibly confusing. So when I was homeless, I lived in the state of California. And it was, you have to go to this county office for this service, but this city office for that service. And part of my frustration was that I just got lost in the maze of it. It was like being sent from A to B to C. These organizations did not communicate with each other. And it was just a nightmare. It was just a bureaucratic nightmare. And eventually the thing that got me out of homelessness was actually just a friend of mine who said, "Do you want to come sleep on the couch in my garage? And then I'll give you a job managing my store inventory for $10 an hour." So Compassion Seattle caught my interest because it seems to kind of have everything that anybody would want while also kind of kicking away the things that people don't like, i.e. people sleeping on the street, encampments, so on and so forth. So based on what we just heard, what is your takeaway from this?
Absolutely. And it definitely caught my attention when they introduced this or announced that they were going to be doing this at the first of the month, because I've been reporting on the homelessness situation here for the entirety of my time here since 2010. And it's gotten progressively worse every year. We've got different leadership and they have different plans and the city council's different and the mayor's different. And actually, a state lawmaker suggested to me last week that they never really let anything actually do what they, you know what I mean? Like they switch so quickly.
Right. Yeah.
Nothing ever gets a chance to do what it's supposed to,
yeah,
for one. But the biggest question I always get is, when are we going to see a visible difference, right? When are there not going to be people in tents sleeping on the sidewalks or sleeping in the parks? And that's what caught my eye, because the original version of this seemed to be very strong in that area while also being compassionate and, kind of appeasing the homeless advocates who get very upset about if you take away the homes of the people which are in the park.
Right. And my understanding is that this has something like a $200 million price tag attached to it, correct?
Yes, something like that. And their position was originally and remains that the city council has enough dollars. The city has the money. They just have to move stuff around.
Right.
So they don't intend to, propose any way to bring in more money.
Yeah. And that's the other part of it that I found that was really fascinating. Said, hey, we already have all of the resources necessary to make this program work. And so why don't we just divert resources? Something that I have been talking about now for the better part of a year, which is that you don't need to continue to tax people. You don't need to continue to kind of ramp everything up. You already have this money. It's just the issue is that you've spread it out in so many different places that it's now basically unaccounted for.
Right. There's definitely some budgeting that could be going on in that area.
Right. And so the other thing that kind of got me about it is that is the idea that we just simply will no longer allow people to literally rot in the street. And one of the things that I saw this weekend, Hannah Scott, National Treasure, was I saw a picture that somebody took of some of the tents set up outside of Meany Middle School before it was swept. And there was a katana, a Japanese sword, stuck outside of this tent that was near these kids. And everybody was saying, oh, well, these people are just, they just really need our kindness and we need to let them sit there. And I was thinking to myself, I would not allow someone with a katana within 100 yards of a bunch of teeny tiny small kids.
No, absolutely not. And that is not a rare occurrence. Okay. Right. I've been at the parks and the places where they sweep these tents out. And a lot of not everyone has these, but a lot of people have, the cops will bring out and lay out what they have or send pictures of it. And there's a hatchet almost always. And there's various, you know, needles and all of that, but there's always some kind of stabbing weapon, if you will. And I think to some degree that's to protect oneself when you're in there. There was, in certain encampments, there was really a lot of rape going on.
Yes.
One of the biggest failures, I don't know if you remember, there was a gentleman who had been featured for several years in various news programs, Cairo 7 TV, Como News, all of them had it. His name was Travis Berge.
Yes.
And he was, right, he was this most prolific offender. He would get arrested and he would be out. And, you know, TV News had him using his syringe to get water out of the sewer to make his heroin and things like that. Maybe it was sometime after the protests up at the Capitol Hill, Cal Anderson Park, where they were all camping out. He had murdered his girlfriend.
Yeah.
And then threw himself into, I believe it was like a vat of bleach in some city owned thing, but it was one of the biggest failures. His sisters had been on the news calling for him to stay in jail and for judges to please keep him there because he was going to hurt himself or someone else. So when you talk about rotting on the street and the weapons and stuff, you don't want that around the middle school, right?
Right. And this is why I'm all for this idea, Compassion Seattle. And when they first started talking about it, I thought, what a great common sense idea to just divert all of these funds back into one place and then have it be there. Because again, when I was homeless, the issue was, there's an office that you go over here for housing, and then there's an office over here that you go for food stamps, and you just get lost in the bureaucratic maze of it. And to simplify the system, I think would be so beneficial for so many people. Hannah Scott, thank you so much for coming on the Dory Monson Show. We appreciate your time as per usual. We have to take a really quick break. We'll wrap all of this up when we get back. We'll be right back after this. Welcome back to the Dory Monson Show. I'm Jack Stein, sitting in for Dory Monson on the first day of his well-deserved vacation. It is the final segment of the show, which means that it is time for
today's sign that the end is near.
So today's sign that the end is near is that Bill Maher and I actually agree on something, which is that people who consider themselves to be liberal or people who consider themselves to be more lefty are actually very misinformed about COVID-19. As a matter of fact, I actually think it's easy for anybody to be misinformed about COVID-19 if you don't have a computer and if you don't know how to use Google. If you don't have those two things, then you have no idea what's going on with COVID-19. But on his show, Politically Incorrect, he was talking about how, liberals just got this totally, totally wrong. Here's a little bit of the audio from Friday's show.
What about liberals? You know, the high information by the science people. In a recent Gallup survey, Democrats did much worse than Republicans in getting the right answer to the fundamental question, what are the chances that someone who gets COVID will need to be hospitalized? The answer is between 1 and 5%. 41% of Democrats thought it was over 50%.
This is what makes this clip so great, is because Maher, for all of his shortcomings, the guy is intellectually consistent. And that's all I want out of anybody in the United States, is just please be intellectually consistent. Because we can have disagreements about this policy or that policy or this candidate or that candidate. But as long as we're all intellectually consistent, we can actually have that conversation. And right now, Bill Maher and I are on the same page when it comes to just how foolish so many people can be when it comes to COVID-19. I'll give you an example. The other night on Cairo Nights, I was talking about how I believe that we need to replace Fauci with a new physician. And somebody texts in on the text line, 98973, and they say, Anthony Fauci is here to protect us. Anthony Fauci knows what's going on. You see, so people have this very reactive nature to things that almost anybody else could agree with. So here is the rest of the clip from Bill Maher.
Another 28% put the chances at 20 to 49. So almost 70% of Democrats are wildly off on this key question and also have a greatly exaggerated view of the danger of COVID-2 and the mortality rate among children. All of which explains why today the states with the highest share of schools that are still closed are all blue states.
This is exactly right. And moreover, you can go to the CDC webpage right now and you can look up the mortality rates in people under the age of 18. It's something like 260. 260 in the United States. Isn't that unbelievable? Now, if you go 18 to 27, that goes to about 5,300 kids. Above that, you're looking at anybody over the age of 45. You're looking at something like 80 to 90% of the people who die from COVID-19 are over the age of 45. So you want to talk about lockdowns, Jay Inslee. You want to talk about phase one, phase two, phase three. Why aren't you including that metric in with the rest of the data? Why aren't you including that and saying, well, it's obvious that if you are a young child, you should be able to go to school and not worry about contracting COVID-19 or dying from COVID-19. Oh, this is the thing that is so frustrating about all of this. All of the data is there. We all have the same data. So how is it possible that so many people are reaching conclusions that are madness in comparison with it, with what anybody else might say about it? So you might say, if you're a common sense individual, wow, 80 to 90% mortality rate if you're over the age of 45, I better be really careful. I better be really careful when it comes to contracting COVID-19 because I don't want to die from COVID-19. Now, the likelihood of me actually passing away from it is actually much lower than previously thought. But still, the majority of people who die from COVID-19 are over the age of 45. So I better be really careful. If you're under the age of 45, what are you doing in a phase one, phase two, phase three, phase four circumstance? It makes no sense whatsoever. And yet the lie continues to be propagated because at this point, I believe that that's what people want to hear. Maybe they've just gotten so used to mommy state. Maybe they've just gotten so used to nanny state that they no longer feel as if they can take care of themselves, that they no longer feel as if they can make decisions for themselves and their families. Now, I know that we had Dr. Z on earlier on in the show, and Dr. Z has his ideas about COVID-19 and what it means to treat COVID-19. But I think that as long as we're all just intellectually honest about the data, we can come to conclusions for the benefit of all. And if you're not, then what are you doing? So this is why people get exceedingly suspicious of someone like Jay Inslee. This is why people get exceedingly suspicious of someone like Anthony Fauci, because we all have access to the same data. We can all look at Google. We all have computers. We can all look it up and look at the raw data that everybody else has. And then when you speak to people as if they are children and as if they do not know what is going on, and you tell people that they have to double mask, and you tell people that they have to stay 6 feet apart from each other, and then all of a sudden it's 3 feet apart from each other as long as you're a school child. I mean, all of this adds up and it becomes more and more and more ridiculous. Then when you're in a restaurant and you can take your mask off as long as you're sitting down, but if you stand back up again, you got to put the mask back on. It is exceedingly ridiculous. And yet people put up with it. They buy into the lie. So I appreciate Bill Maher coming on and saying, hey, everybody, we no longer need to do this anymore. My party, meaning Bill Maher's party, the party of Democrats, can wake up to the fact that they are very much so misinformed about COVID-19. And it's time to move on from it. If I can impart anything from you in the final segment of the Dory Monson Show, we beat COVID-19. We won. We don't need to worry about it anymore. Speaking of, I will be back tomorrow to fill in for Dory Monson, who is on his vacation. We will be back then. Thanks so much to Nicole and everybody else on staff. We will see you tomorrow.